From Toronto, it's time for your weekly dose of conservation information here on Canada's All Environmental News Hour. On behalf of CIUT 89.5 in Toronto and our fantastic community radio partners across the country, I'm Darren Kaster, and welcome to the Green Majority. First off, in the first half, we have Christopher Stevens with the Ontario Sustainable Energy Association, who's going to be talking to us a little bit about Ontario's feed-in tariff program, otherwise known as FIT, which apparently is not as fit as it used to be. They're asking people to call their MPs, email their MPs about the feed-in tariff program. Last we had heard on the program, or last I'd sort of heard, was that Ontario's FIT program was actually something to be heralded from the mountaintops and was an example to all the rest of the world. So we're going to hear from Chris, find out exactly what the 911 is, find out what's going on with Ontario's program, and maybe some implications for the rest of the world. They also had a note on their page as well about talking about how Germany now has an actual action plan to get towards 100% renewable energy. So we're going to compare and contrast those two in the first half. We'll also be joined throughout the program here and there by Liam O'Doherty of Taking It Global as well, and I've got Liam Azzolini in the studio as well. We're also going to hear from Arthur Potts Dawson, who is a restaurateur in the UK, with his TED Talk, which is called A Vision for Sustainable Restaurants. He talks about his journey of putting together, building some restaurants with some cutting-edge technology and some stuff he found in his garage, an interesting mix of trying to create a low-impact restaurant, and they're actually moving on, he discusses at the end of that talk as well, to create a community-based co-op platform, but also sustainably built and run and housed and energied and everything, supermarket as well in the UK. So we'll hear from Arthur Potts Dawson later in the program as well. First off, though, we're going to have a quick sort of update on one of the things we have Environment Canada findings are a wake-up call for Alberta. That's an article that was in the Edmonton Journal. Leah, I know that you as well are reading this kind of consistently as I am, over time, and we have as well being mentioned in the article, of course, David Schindler, who was our guest a few weeks ago. But the main story here is that I'm aware of how mainstream media generally writes these sorts of stories, and if you were to just read the headline, my impression would be that that something really, really devastating and important was happening, and that this was going to change policy. But I mean, I don't know. Do you get the same feeling that I do as you're skimming the headlines, that this is sort of always the headline on this sort of story, and that?
Well, yes, it's always that they give all this evidence that basically that the oil sands is, you know, it's detrimental to the environment. I mean, they actually use in this specific article that they have research actually from David Schindler saying that it's four times bigger than they identified previously. So they're actually using information from 2 years ago, even in just to kind of back this article up. Now, it's funny that, you know, you'd use our, you know, information from, you know, previous years, and you think with all this information that things would change, and it takes an NDP environmental critic to announce this when our actual government should be actually doing something about it.
Mm. Now, as an aside, of course, as well, we don't have any position on any particular political parties or anything like that. But I mean, these are some pretty serious issues. They were talking about methylmercury here, which is a massive neurotoxin, and specifically for younger people, it creates development disorders. Really, really nasty stuff. Just being absolutely pumped into the environment here, and I think this is an opportunity to sort of harp on our ongoing coverage of the muzzling of Canadian scientists. Although it does seem like this time this Environment Canada report did make it through the filters, but it also makes one wonder if there is such a clampdown, as we heard from David Schindler and every guest we've had on the program talking about the access of Canadian scientists to show their findings to the media, have all said that there's, you know, almost all of it, if not all of it, has to go through all sorts of filters, and that there's sort of federal officials whose job it is to make it the science sound beneficial to the government, or you know, to screen what's being put out. And so my only concern here, I mean, is a couple of things I would take from this story. Go ahead, we're going to have the article up on the website. You can take a look for yourself. But my impression here is one is a couple of things. One is, yes, this is about the 10,000th story coming out saying of scientific evidence of massive environmental damage. And when we're talking about environmental damage, we're not just talking about, you know, some trees being ripped up or some water being polluted. This is, you know, affecting human health as well. So depending on what your priorities are, maybe, you know, you're just interested in the environment for our own purposes, then I think there's still a convincing case to be made that this is pretty terrible. So on the one hand, I mean, how many stories have we had out that and still there's the federal government is plowing straight ahead. We were just watching some coverage the other day with Harper congratulating Obama on his recent win, but emphasizing in his congratulations sort of, you know, working together on energy, nationalizing energy or this sort of thing, or, you know, reducing the dependence on
foreign oil.
Which was, of course, is a cue to this, of course, to strengthen things and pipelines and all this sort of things running to the U.S. And the other point to take from that as well is that, you know, if this is the nasty sort of news that makes it through the federal filters, I'm scared to find out what's actually being reported. Anyway, you can have a read for yourself. The article will be available made on the website after the show as well. Again, that was Sarah O'Donnell with the Edmonton Journal. We're going to move on now to our first feature. I believe I have Christopher Stevens with the Ontario Sustainable Energy Association on the line. How are you doing today, Chris? Chris? Oh, maybe just a technical brief moment. And we'll we're going to be talking to Chris about some of the German plans getting to 100% renewable energy. When we do, it seems like we just may have had a line drop there. We'll get him back on in a minute. The other thing that we were going to discuss with Chris Stevens, who's the executive director over there at the Ontario Sustainable Energy Association, was them talking about the FIT contracts. There's a lot of work. Oh, we may... Anyway, so we'll relate to this anyway. I'll come back to this as well, because Germany has a long been a leader on renewable energy. They've been reducing the amount of nuclear that they've had as well. Am I getting a nod now that I have Chris on the line?
Yeah, I'm here now. Thanks, Darren.
There you are. Oh, fantastic. Thank you so much for talking to us this morning, Chris. I want to get to the thing about Germany's plan for 100% renewable energy in a moment. But first off, you guys set out a call to action. I don't normally see this sort of posting from OSEA. Generally, it's more kind of news items and updates. Tell me about why you've decided you think there's an urgent call to action necessary here.
No problem. Well, the FIT program, or FIT 2.0, the second installment, the review started at the end of last year, and basically since July of 2011, no new contracts have been issued under the FIT program, and the FIT program being the program that provides a fair long-term contract with a reasonable return on investment to homeowners, community groups, commercial developers who want to develop solar, wind, biogas, hydro projects. So for the last basically 16 months, the program has been on hold. And initially, we were told that the program was going to launch in January, then it was going to be in the summertime. Most recently, it was October the 1st. It was supposed to go live. And here we are now at the end of November almost, and the program still hasn't gone live. And we've got manufacturers that have been attracted to Ontario that have invested a significant chunk of money, almost $30 billion. We've got homeowners, we've got community groups, First Nations, schools, churches, developers that have got money on the line that are laying off folks, and we really just need to get the program going. The stability that's key to building a new sector and driving an industry needs to be there, and for whatever reason, things have been continuously delayed.
So, I mean, you said that was obviously you anticipated my immediate following question there with for whatever reason. Do you have any idea why that there would be such? I mean, there was quite bravado when this idea came out. We saw all sorts of news headlines about what an amazing world example, you know, that other provinces, countries, states, whatever, should be, you know, learning from our excellent program. Why do you have any theory as to why this ball has been dropped and why all these people have been sort of left out to dry?
Well, you know, I think that we do still have a great program, and we have a great piece of legislation that addresses both energy efficiency and renewables. That's the Green Energy and Green Economy Act. I think that that, you know, there's a number of things at play. There's the system will resist change, right? We've got a significant move from a centralized system to a decentralized system, a shift from largely commercial operations and some big public power to the idea that the communities and individual citizens can be participants or partners in projects. So I think that there's some institutional resistance. At the same time, I think a lot of it has to do with politics. The reality is that we had an election last year, and the Green Energy and Green Economy Act, despite being nonpartisan, was under attack. Now we've had a lot of delays, a number of changes in ministers. I think there's been at least 8 or 9 ministers of energy since before, just before the Green Energy Act was passed. So there's been lots of changes, lots of things happening, lots of delays. Now the premier has stepped down, so there's a election going on for who will be the leader of the Liberal Party and who will therefore be the premier until the next election happens. So there's lots of things happening around the sphere. And at the same time, the bureaucrats need clear direction from their leadership. And I think the renewable energy industry has been patiently waiting for things to go live. But the patience is running out because people's livelihoods are on the line. And they're applying the pressure to their MPPs to get things moving again so that the MPPs get the Minister of Energy and the Premier to give the nod to the Ontario Power Authority to get this program live again.
Okay, so talk a little bit about the consequences here, because, I mean, just to sort of put it into context, when you're talking about industry building, this is different than if we were talking about another maybe more traditional manufacturing sector or whatever kind of aspect of renewable energy you want to be talking about, where maybe, you know, there's a rule change and delaying the rule change may, you know, cause some minor issue of them rolling out certain, you know, programs or this or that. But when we're talking about sort of starting an industry, as you're saying, what exactly would be the consequences of the ball getting completely dropped here?
There's I guess a couple of things. So one is that we've got a significant chunk of manufacturing that came here. People invested their money, both Canadians and Ontarians, as well as some foreign investment, to set up manufacturing in Ontario in a time when our economy was in the hole, and it wasn't just Ontario; it was the rest of the world. So our automotive sector was collapsing back in 2008, and the green energy sector was seen as a new opportunity, a space to move into. And you see companies like Samco Solar that went from producing automotive parts to producing racking for solar, a lot of other companies that have done the same sort of thing. So they've transitioned, they've created products, and they've expected that there would be an Ontario market, and there hasn't been. So instead, which is a good thing, they've gone into other markets, but at the same time, the base that they were expecting, the market here in Ontario is disappearing. So we don't want to lose these companies. We don't want them to go someplace else. And the same holds true for community groups, for commercial developers who have put in applications for renewable energy projects. You know, how many businesses do you know that could wait a year and a half for work to happen? Not many.
Yeah. Right? So it's more than if I catch you correctly, it's more than just, you know, some people losing some money, which I mean, it would be terrible anyway. But it's as far as something within the renewable sector, it's kind of a new and emerging sector. This is an expanding market. It's global. As I said, I want to get to in a minute is Germany's kind of advances on that, and they've been doing very, very well with advancing the alternative energy. Not always necessarily even to their immediate financial benefit, just making an investment in their future. But as you're saying, I mean, these are companies and investors who are looking for a place to stick their money into. And it's not even so much that, you know, if Ontario doesn't get their act together on this immediately, that they'll just kind of come back around for round two. There's other places to invest.
That's true. And the thing is that it's the big investors, but it's also the little folks. So it's people like you and I who have put money into a cooperative or into a community-based project or a municipality that's invested in projects. They've done all of this legwork and then have been sitting in limbo with their resources tied up or spent already. And now we're going, okay, so are we going to get to move ahead? You know, I think there were some issues with the draft rules that came out, and those have been worked on, and there's been consultations going on. But at the same time, the reality is we just need to get things moving. Things aren't ever going to be perfect, but that's why we have a regular review process for the program. And at the same time, we just need to make sure that our industry that we've attracted stays, whether it's the small guys or the big guys.
Absolutely. So people, if they're looking for more information on that or sort of recommendations on what exactly to say to their MPP, of course, you've got a link up on your website if you want to maybe plug that for a second.
Yeah, that's right. So our website is www.ontario.ca. hyphen SEA is in sustainableenergyassociation.org. So if you go to ontario-sea.org, you'll be able to check out the letter. We've also got a number of other resources that are there, and I know you wanted to chat about Germany, so I'll just put a little bit of an early plug in. On December 6th, we've actually got someone coming from Germany, and possibly two people, who are going to talk about the energy revolution or the energy Wende that's going on over there. That we're going to do a webinar, and so people can tap into that wherever they are around the province or around the country.
Absolutely. So on that note, let's move on to Germany just for a minute here before I know you've got a busy day ahead of you. Well, just before we let you go there was an article that you have referenced on your website as well, talking about how Germany has a plan to get to 100% renewable energy. It also outlines that since 2000, Germany's converted 25% of its power grid to renewable energy sources such as solar, wind, and biomass. So what are they doing that we're not?
They've done a bunch of things. I think the first one is to not listen to those that are entrenched in the current energy system who say that it's impossible. Instead of saying, "Oh, well, if you say so, you're the expert. We can't do anything. We'll just throw up our hands." Folks have actually said, "You know what? We can envision a new place, a new reality for ourselves, and at the same time, we can democratize our energy system." So, what you've seen is really local folks getting together and either doing their own projects on their own properties or getting together with their neighbors and erecting windmills, doing solar projects, that sort of thing. Now, there is also a big chunk of industry. The commercial developers are making things happen, and in the best instances, either the community or a community commercial venture exists. So Germany has about 20 years head start on us here in Ontario, and the Green Energy and Green Economy Act and feed-in tariff is based on their framework. Now they've got basically every year 250,000 jobs created, it's significant industry, lots of investment going in, but they've also been chipping away and changing their energy system and getting rid of dirty nuclear. They're also phasing out coal. Even though folks will say, well, they've built more coal plants, but yes, they have, but they're actually using less coal power because as more renewables fill in the gap, it's actually pushing power prices down, it's stabilizing the grid, and it's providing an asset that they can export to other places where they want clean energy too.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the numbers outlined here as well is that individuals and cooperatives own 65% of Germany's renewable energy capacity compared to 2% in the U.S. That's quite a shocking difference. I imagine it would be roughly close to the U.S. number here in Canada. I don't know if you know that off the top of your head.
Yeah, you're right. And the thing is that in Ontario, we don't have a very cooperative or community cohesive culture. So we've got a bit of a challenge because we're not starting at the same starting point as some of these communities in Germany or in Denmark have done. I think Quebec or some parts of eastern Canada or even out in the prairies where there is much more of a collective cooperative culture, it's easier for these sorts of things to take hold. At the same time, what we do have here in Ontario is we have service groups, we've got faith organizations, we've got schools, churches, we've got community buildings, and the key is to find a group that's already cohesive, that has a mission, and to tie it together with an entity that has an asset. So Brant County is a great example. The municipality is providing assets to cooperatives to get projects going. The cooperatives are plugging into the Rotary, into the other service clubs and stuff in the community to try and make things happen and move things forward and create the similar sort of culture that you see in Germany.
So, I mean, that combining that with another sort of factoid that I had as well, just sort of off the top of my brain, you were talking about we're talking about the 65% of Germany's renewable being owned by individuals and cooperatives. So I wasn't aware of that number was that drastically high. What I was sort of aware of was that in Germany, actually, even though I don't believe they're the leader anymore, I believe China's overtaken them as far as actual coverage of solar panels, but in a per capita or per land area space, they still have an extremely high amount of solar. Mm-hmm. They're not in any way they don't have that because they have the best solar exposure on the planet. They actually have quite bad in some areas, if I understand correctly. What I'm sort of getting from that was just the idea that these are being done by individuals because they see it as the right thing to do, not some sort of bureaucratic government top down. Let's invest $10 billion in this over the next 3 years. These are just people saying, no, this is what I want, and this is what we're going to do.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that there's a couple key factors here. The feed-in tariff that they use there and that we have here in Ontario is really effective because, one, it's transparent in how the price is set. It's supposed to be cost plus a reasonable return on investment, and we can debate what that reasonable return on investment should be. It also prevents cost overruns because the generator only gets paid for producing power. So they don't get any subsidies or payments up front like some of our big power producers do. These guys only get paid if they actually produce the power. And it's a long-term contract, so it creates the security so that whether you're a big or a small guy, you can go to the bank or you can go to your lenders or your investors and get them to put the money on the line to make the project happen. So it's the private sector or the community sector that actually invests rather than the government borrowing money to make projects happen.
So you mentioned you gave me the absolute perfect segue, and I swear to all our listeners, we didn't plan this ahead of time. You just gave me the perfect intro for my very last question before I let you go, Chris, which is that I said a few weeks ago on the show that before I die one day, someone is going to explain to me why oil companies get subsidies. You mentioned the magic word subsidy. You're giving the example here that this isn't a subsidy that you get beforehand as an incentive. This is just simply a guaranteed return on investment after the fact. After you've produced the energy. For whatever answer you may give, I have to ask you, can you give me your best answer as to why oil companies get subsidies?
Well, I think that in the early days when they weren't financially viable, subsidies were put in place to help them get going. Just like most technologies, if you look at our phones, our computers, all these things came largely because of government support in R&D and getting things off the ground. And as those technologies or solutions get entrenched, it's hard to trim the cream or to take away the benefits because they say, well, we're job creators, so you don't want to take away our resources, we won't be able to survive.
It must be really, really hard being the most being the richest, most powerful corporations on the planet.
Yeah, for sure.
I feel really terrible for them. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us. Executive Director of Ontario Sustainable Energy Association, Christopher Stevens, thanks again.
Thanks for having me, Darren. Take care.
All right. So we're going to go to a music break. We'll be back in just a minute. Thanks so much. All right, and we are back here listening to The Green Majority. I'd also like to do a shout-out as well to Amber at Open Till Midnight Blogs. One of the things that I've always sort of felt really bad about on this show is that we have an opportunity to play Canadian tracks here, of course, due to Canadian content laws. At least two-thirds of our music has to be Canadian. I actually am very proud to say that with almost no exceptions, 100% of the music that we play on this show is Canadian. However, I'm busy reading articles on the environment. I'm as much as I'm a music fan, I don't really have a lot of time to go out and do a really good job looking for cool new music. So I realize if any regular listeners of the show may have noticed that we tend to replay the same song somewhat over and over again, depending on how much time I have, or be a little bit lazy and play three songs off the same CD, that sort of thing. That will happen no longer. We now have someone at an actual real-time music enthusiast to the extent that I am an environment news enthusiast who will be programming our music, so I would like to welcome us very much. She's not on the line, unfortunately. It kind of sounded like I was actually introducing her, but Amber over at Open Till Midnight Blogs. We're going to have otmblog.com, I believe. I'm terrible. I needed to double-check that. There will be a link to everything on our website as well. Names of the tracks and everything that will be on the thing on the website as well with each and every show for all the music that we play. Because now, pretty much exclusively, I understand, we're going to be playing Canadian, largely indie music, so a lot of new bands, people that Canadians that could use your support. So if you like some of the music that you hear on the show, please do go actually to the website and check them out, because these will largely not be your Nickelbacks and that sort of things. These are people that actually probably could use your support as well. That's sort of the idea that we have around the show is getting good information and now hopefully some good music to people that need it, so that we can either support our favorite environmental cause, be better informed about it, or support and be a better informed about some Canadian music. So we're very happy to announce that partnership and hopefully happy to announce better music being played here on The Green Majority as well. So that, of course, once again, was Open Till Midnight Blog. All the track information and names of the artists, all that sort of things, and links to their Bandcamp pages largely will be available made on the website after the fact as well. For now, we're going to move on to another quick thing, which is that a settlement total $4.5 billion U.S. Is being paid due to the BP Gulf Skill. That's the Deepwater Horizon. We have a couple of charges coming out of that as well. BP rig workers Robert Kaluza and Donald Vindrine. Federal charges of manslaughter and involuntary manslaughter, accused of repeatedly disregarding abnormal high pressure readings that should have indicated trouble just before the blowout, and as well BP's former vice president of exploration for the Gulf of Mexico charged with obstruction of Congress and making false statements. I watched, Leah, actually some of the video about this as well. Someone had made a compilation of him basically saying that he'd lied on the record, and then on the record saying he'd lied about 50 times.
Yeah, lied to Congress.
It was basically just like someone had made like a mixtape of him saying yes, no, that was not, and this, and yes, and that was not true, no, and you said it anyway. Yes, and it was just brutal. I mean, you couldn't even get through it. You couldn't actually even get through it. But I mean, this is too big news. I mean, I'm somewhat skeptical of the effects of this. I would like to get perhaps we'll get someone on a little bit better versed with this very specific issue next week, maybe to talk about a little bit of the implications. I don't want to promise anything for sure, but we are hoping to get Jill Stein of the Green Party on for next week's program. I will ask her about this if we're able to get her on. She was the presidential candidate for the Green Party in the U.S., the recently finished American elections. But, I mean, for now, this seems like a win. I don't know. How do you feel about it?
Well, the thing is that, like, they're making a lot more money than, you know, $4.5 billion. I mean, I believe last year it was just over $25 billion they made. So for them, it's not that bad. I mean, it's something that they can definitely afford. Now, the other thing is that there's a federal judge in New Orleans, and they're deciding to approve an estimated $7.8 billion settlement between BP and more than 100,000 businesses in the surrounding area that can include like fisheries and other businesses around the Gulf of Mexico. So that's also another thing that'll come into play maybe in a short while. So does it really hurt them right now? Not that much. Another thing is that with this, people kind of forget that not only there was an environmental factor, that 11 people actually died from this. And the fact that they lied about that's, you know, that's why that there's those manslaughter charges. So, yeah, I think it wasn't as bad as or as a strong of a fine that I thought that they would get from it. So,
well, yeah. I guess it really depends sort of what side of the fence you're sitting on. From their stay or shareholders, I mean, that's roughly a fifth of their annual income. That's got to hurt. If you're talking about in comparison to the profit they made, yes, they still made a lot of money. Does this send an? I mean, the point of this sort of thing, the point of that is not necessarily always just to compensate those that have been damaged, but it's also supposed to send a message. Does a $4.5 billion price tag? You don't think that sends a message to other oil companies that they shouldn't take risks, or what do you think?
No, I mean it totally does. But just like in the grand scheme of things, they're just going to keep on going. I mean, yes, they're slapped with this fine, and a couple of people are going to be going to jail because of this. But I mean, it's still in the long run, it's not going to stop anything.
Does the company as a whole, really care about these two guys that went to jail?
I mean, absolutely not. Absolutely not. That it doesn't matter to them. So yeah. No, not at all.
And I mean, I think what's helpful in sort of picking through these sorts of things a little bit as well is you sort of have to have a little bit of an understanding of sort of how corporate structure works. And then when we're talking about massive companies like this with boards of directors and everything, if this was a mom and pop store and we were running a pizza store and the pizza store got dinged with a fine for maybe, they put out some bad pizza and killed a couple of people and a quarter of their annual, revenue was taken away such that they still made a profit. They would be amazing. Are you kidding? Like the fact that they weren't immediately shut down and just scattered four sheets to the wind, that would be an amazing triumph for them. So I think right. That's one way to look at it. But the other way to look at it too is that, if say the mother of the mom and pop pizza store got fired as well, the other guy would be sitting there going, man, that could have just as easily happened to me. I better watch out with how I'm making these pizzas. But a mom and pop pizza store doesn't have a board of directors and they don't have shareholders. And it's the board of directors that are largely aren't really liable for much. And the shareholders aren't really liable for anything other than their loss of profits. And they lost some profits here. But the point is they still made a profit. Mm-hmm. So on the balance sheet of, did we get a win or not? They made a ton of money. They made a ton of money out of the drilling in the first place. Then they lost a bunch from some of the investments and from the cleanup and from this. But overall, they still made a profit. At the end of the day, the kind of amoral machine that is the corporate structure still sees a profit. They still proceed.
Right.
Like these, you sort of can't think about these sorts of things in the way that you would think about making an individual decision, which, I mean, I don't want to get too Noam Chomsky on you here, but this is sort of when we get into conversations about corporations as a human being, because if the corporation was a single individual and they got, threatened with a 50-year prison sentence, they might listen to you. But there's no actual liability here. And the people that are making the money aren't the people that are sort of being threatened with put in jail or fined, and the people who profit from the company being a company are still making a profit. I don't really see what the deterrent here is.
The mom and pop shop is making thousands of dollars. They're still making billions of dollars. So
to mention that they still have subsidies.
And they still have subsidies. And it's actually funny because the former BP chief executive Tony Hayward said that he quote unquote wants to have his life back. So, I don't know what kind of a life that it was taken away from him, but he supposedly wants his life back. He's getting a lot of criticism for that.
He may now be in a Honda rather than his Bentley. A really, really nice Honda, I'm sure. But,
a really nice Honda.
Anyway, moving on, we're going to go now to, we're going to go and listen to another clip. This is a TED Talks talking about Arthur Potts. He's talking about sustainable restaurants. I think it's a nice break from a little bit of Hoyle, heavy corporate talk and politics, with some really interesting ideas about how a small business can create a sustainable business. And he really looks at it from all angles. Highly recommend it. So stay tuned. We're going to be listening to TED Talks about sustainable restaurants.
Restaurants and the food industry in general are pretty much the most wasteful industry in the world. For every calorie of food that we consume here in Britain today, 10 calories are taken to produce it. That's a lot. And I want to take something rather humble to discuss. I found this in the farmer's market today. And if anybody wants to take it home and mash it later, you're very welcome to. The humble potato. And I spent a long time, 25 years preparing these. And it pretty much goes through 8 different forms in its lifetime. First of all, it's planted, and that takes energy. It grows and is nurtured. It's then harvested. It's then distributed, and distribution is a massive issue. It's then sold and bought, and it's then delivered to me. You know, I basically take it, prepare it, and then people consume it. Hopefully they enjoy it. And the last stage is basically waste. And this is pretty much where everybody just disregards it. There are different types of waste. There's a waste of time, there's a waste of space, there's a waste of energy, and there's a waste of waste. And every business I've been working on over the past 5 years, I'm trying to lower each one of those elements. Okay, so you ask what a sustainable restaurant looks like. Basically, a restaurant that looks like just like any other. This is the restaurant, Acorn House, front and back. So let me run you through a few ideas. Floor, sustainable, recyclable. Chairs, recycled and recyclable. Tables, Forestry Commission. This is Norwegian Forestry Commission wood. This bench, although it was uncomfortable for my mum, she didn't like sitting on it, so she went and bought these cushions for me from a local jumble sale, reusing, which I thought was pretty good. I hate waste, especially walls. If they're not working, put a shelf on it, which I did, and that shows all the customers my products. The whole business is run on sustainable energy. This is powered by wind. All of the lights are daylight bulbs. Paint is all low volume of chemical, which is very important when you're working in the room all the time. I was experimenting with these, I don't know if you can see it, but there's this sort of work surface there, and that's a plastic polymer. And I was thinking, right, I was trying to think nature, nature, nature. Then I thought, no, experiment with resins, experiment with polymers. Will they outlive me? They probably might. Right, here's a reconditioned coffee machine. Actually, it looks better than a brand new one, so looking good there. Now, reusing is vital. And we filter all our own water, we put them in bottles, refrigerate them, and then we reuse that bottle again and again and again. Here's a great little example. If you can see this orange tree, it's actually growing in a car tire, which has been turned inside out, sewn up. It's got my compost in it, which is growing an orange tree, which is great. This is the kitchen, which is in the same room. I basically created a menu that allowed people to choose the amount and the volume of food that they wanted to consume. Rather than me putting a dish down, they were allowed to help themselves to as much or little as they wanted. Okay, it's a small kitchen. It's about 5 square meters. It serves 220 people a day. We generate quite a lot of waste. This is the waste room. Now, you can't get rid of waste. But this store is not about eliminating it. It's about minimizing it. In here, I have produce and boxes that are unavoidable. I put my food waste into this dehydrating, desiccating macerator, turns food into an inert material, which I can store and then compost later. I compost it in this garden. All of the soil you can see there is basically my food, which is generated by the restaurant, and it's growing in these tubs, which are made out of storm-felled trees and wine caskets and all kinds of things. 3 compost bins. Go through about 70 kilos of raw vegetable waste a week. Really good. Makes fantastic compost. A couple of wormeries in there too. And actually one of the wormeries was a big wormery. I had a lot of worms in it. And I tried taking the dried food waste, putting it into the worms. I said, there you go. Dinner. That's like, you know, vegetable jerky. And killed all of them. I mean, it's like, I don't know how many worms in there, but I got some heavy karma coming, I'll tell you. What you're seeing here is a water filtration system. So this takes the water out of the restaurant, runs it through these stone beds. It's going to be mint in there, and then I sort of water the garden with it. And I ultimately want to recycle that and put it back into the loos, maybe wash hands with it, I don't know. So water is a very important aspect. Started meditating on that and created a restaurant called Waterhouse. If I could get Waterhouse to be a no-carbon restaurant that is consuming no gas to start with, that would be great. Managed to do it. This restaurant looks a little bit like Acorn House, same chairs, same tables, you know, they're all English and a little bit more sustainable. But this is an electrical restaurant. The whole thing is electric, the restaurant and the kitchen. And it's run on hydroelectricity, so I've gone from air to water. Now, it's important to understand that, you know, this room is cooled by water, heated by water, filters its own water, it's powered by water. It literally is Waterhouse. The air handling system inside it, I got rid of air conditioning because I thought it was too much consumption going on there. This is basically air handling. I'm taking the temperature of the canal outside, pumping it through heat exchange mechanism. It's turning into these amazing sails in the roof, and that in turn is falling softly onto the people in the restaurant, cooling them or heating them as the need may be. And this is the English Willow air diffuser, and that's softly moving that air current through the room. Very advanced, and no air conditioning. I love it. In the canal, which is just outside the restaurant, there's hundreds of meters of coil piping, and this takes the temperature of the canal and turns it into this 4 degrees heat exchange. I have no idea how it works, but I paid a lot of money for it. and what's great is one of the chefs who works in that restaurant lives on this boat. It's off-grid. It generates all its own power. He's growing all his own fruit, and that's fantastic. There's no accident in the names of these restaurants. Acorn House is the element of wood. Waterhouse is the element of water. And I'm thinking, I'm going to be making 5 restaurants based on the 5 Chinese medicine acupuncture specialities. I've got water and wood. I'm just about to do fire. I've got metal and earth to come. So you have to watch your space for that. Okay, so this is my next project. 5 weeks old, it's my baby, and it's hurting real bad. The People Supermarket. So basically, the restaurants only really hit people who believed in what I was doing anyway. What I needed to do is get food out to a broader spectrum of people. So people, i.e. perhaps more working class, or perhaps people who actually believe in a cooperative. This is a social enterprise, not-for-profit, cooperative supermarket. It really is about the social disconnect between food, communities in urban settings, and their relationship to rural growers, connecting communities in London to rural growers. Really important. So I'm committing to potatoes, I'm committing to milk, I'm committing to leeks and broccoli, all very important stuff. I've kept the tiles, I've kept the floors, I've kept the trunking, I've got in some recycled fridges, I've got some recycled tills, I've got recycled trolleys. I mean, the whole thing is super sustainable. In fact, I'm trying and I'm going to make this the most sustainable supermarket in the world. That's zero food waste, and no one's doing that just yet. In fact, if Sainsbury's, if you're watching, let's have a go. Come on, try it on. I'm going to get there before you. Okay, so nature doesn't create waste as such. Everything in nature is used up in a closed, continuous cycle, with waste being the end of the beginning. And that's kind of been something that's been nurturing me for some time, and it's an important statement to understand. If we don't stand up and make a difference and think about sustainable food, think about the sustainable nature of it, then we may fail. But I wanted to get up and show you that we can do it if we're more responsible. Environmentally conscious businesses are doable. They're here. You can see I've done 3 so far. I've got a few more to go. The idea is embryonic. I think it's important. I think that if we reduce, reuse, refuse, and recycle, right at the end there, recycling is, the last point I want to make, but, it's the 4 R's rather than the 3 R's, then I think we're going to be on our way. So these 3 are not perfect. They're ideas. I think that there are many problems to come, but with help, I'm sure I'm going to find solutions. And I hope you all take part. Thank you very much.
All right, and welcome back. I'm Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority. That was Arthur Potts Dawson talking about a vision for sustainable restaurants and really a vision for sustainable businesses in general. He just happens to be a restaurateur. We're going to go now to another music break in just a moment. I would like to plug once again the Open to Midnight blog, who Amber, works on that blog, is now sort of programming the music for our show. Not sort of, she's entirely programming the music for the show because she's as much a music nerd as I am and an environment nerd. So hopefully we'll have a collision of worlds there. And so I think she picked some good music for us this week. The track, I didn't have it handy a minute ago when we were playing the first one, but the track we played earlier in the show was Goodnight Sunrise with Love Fortress number 9. That's a local band from Toronto. We're going to play now another one from Avery Island with a tune called Lock Me Up. This is actually a band from Whitby, Ontario. All of the tracks and links for this music, as well as a link to Open to Midnight blog, will be available on the radio. Where am I saying now? We'll be available on the website after the show when the show goes up. So we'll have a listen to this track again. This is Avery Island with Lock Me Up, and we'll be back in just a minute.
Thank you.
This is Darren. You're listening to The Green Majority. That, again, was Avery Island with Lock Me Up. That's a band from Whitby, Ontario, brought to us by Amber over at Open Till Midnight blog. OTMblog.com is where you can go and check out her stuff. She's a local music blogger who's going to be helping us out with music for the next little while. So thanks very much to her. And we'll have links to all those bands and artists. A lot of them are either free to download or pick your price as well. These are, for the most part, indie bands. So if you like the track, very easy to get a hang of it for either a price you wish to pay, or some of them just give it up for free. So that's pretty fun, and we're very happy to announce that. We're going to do one more news story before we wrap up the program now. This was a headline that we grabbed from the Canadian press, talking about Bob Rae's visit to Toronto, talking about carbon pricing, and talking about the national conversation about carbon tax. Leah, if you want to maybe just explain a little bit about what the story's about.
Yes. Well, he's basically saying that everybody, it's a highly polarized issue, and that basically he wants to end the partisan rhetoric of the issue of carbon taxing. And the thing is that when he kind of hints that even the conservatives even had that carbon taxing is actually important, even though right now they're not on the fence with that. But so he's basically saying that we should really get on board with that. And now this actually comes out the same time as that California just debuted its landmark cap and trade system in reducing carbon emissions, because we well know that California, especially in LA, you know, they have a lot of pollution, a lot of smog, and that they've actually gone out and debuted their landmark cap and trade system. So I think he's actually kind of pointing at that as being that we should kind of jump on board with that, because if California is doing it, we should do it.
Well, yeah, and I mean, the big issue there, of course, is that we saw the failure of the Liberals with the Green Shift plan, tried to make carbon pricing an issue in Canadian politics before, and it's fallen flat on its face kind of resoundingly rejected by the voting public here in Canada as an issue. Now, we did at the time on the Green Majority have a conversation about where that played along with education mixing with rhetoric from various sides. But here and today, it seems like it's coming back again. The Liberals making it an issue for them. They've put themselves at least slotted themselves. I don't know if that I would necessarily agree with it, but they've sort of are trying to present themselves as the reasonable middle between the Conservatives and the NDP here in Canada. Of course, not mentioning the Green Party because nobody ever likes to admit that they exist. trying to put themselves forward as the reasonable middle. I think it's very good that Bob Rae is bringing up the idea of a carbon tax. I think he correctly references the fact that even the Conservative Party used to admit that this was something that was going to have to come around eventually before they started proclaiming it a tax on everything, which, I mean, it essentially is a tax on everything. But the point is that by calling it that, you're sort of, you know, making it tax sounds arbitrary because, you know, mm-hmm. when we're, I think that's the kind of angle from that talking point is when you say, well, it's a tax on everything. Well, we think of it like, you know, for instance, a tax on cigarettes, you know, tax right. could be, we could argue that there's a good reason why there's a tax on cigarettes, but the, you know, the difference between having it at, you know, cigarettes be $10 a pack and $20 a pack is essentially somewhat arbitrary. You're picking a number and then mm-hmm. using, you know, money to reinvest in healthcare and doing this and that. Whereas that when we're talking about something about a carbon tax, that's almost the wrong way to put it, because what we're talking about is setting a price that achieves a goal, and the goal is the reduction of something that's dangerous. We've done this successfully before in Canada. We've done it with ozone depleting chemicals. We've done it with acid rain. We've done it on a wide variety of issues, especially here in Canada and specifically in Ontario. We do have a proud history of dealing with environmental problems by putting a price on the thing that's creating a problem, and maybe even offering up an opportunity or a reward system for people who are doing the right things. We've demonstrated over and over again that this can not only be done effectively, but that it works. And we've done it in a way that, you know, it hasn't destroyed business. It hasn't wiped out a manufacturing sector. That has been quite successful. So there really is no argument against not having a carbon tax at all. I think there's a very healthy debate to be had about what that tax should be, how it should be applied. But we really, there, it's, I don't think it's partisan to say at all that the conservative standpoint that they've picked on this issue of let's just not even discuss it is just out of range with the facts. We have so many examples of this sort of a system working. Nobody disagrees that it's a problem, although they sort of like to, you know, use different language and try and stay as far away as they can from admitting that there's a problem, that this problem has a cause, and that this cause is, you know, fossil fuels, and you know, trying to desperately to stay away from that kind of logical progression of thought because of how much they've sort of gotten in bed with the oil industry. But there is a clear and decisive way to deal with this problem, and I think what Bob Rae, while we as a show don't support or are anti any particular party, I think in this particular case, this particular person has hit the nail on the head in that regardless of if you support the Liberals' approach to dealing with this problem, Bob Rae has correctly identified that this is absolutely ridiculous that we're not having this conversation mm-hmm. and that this should be a legitimate issue. We've got about 30 seconds left for a final comment, Leah.
Well, I mean, especially even as we have now, we're saying, you know, we're going to be kind of having more of a connection with China. And Bob Rae also mentions that, you know, the exploitation of our resources could quite potentially end our economy as we know it, because our economy is basically based on resources, and we have to protect those resources. If we're going to actually use it in the economy, we have to protect it as well. So it's kind of like a double-edged sword.
Okay, so we're out of time, I'm afraid, but I think the point there, the way he put it, was rip it and ship it, not the way to go. Let's be a resource. If we no problem with being a resource-based economy, but we have to make sure we have something to sell more than the next 2 years, at the very, very least.